Hi, I'm Roberta, grateful recovered compulsive overeater. Really happy to be back at the kitchen sink. So many good memories. I was felt very comfortable to see that the format hasn't changed, and although Michael said maybe it will be changing, but that's always group conscience. So anyway, I came into these rooms in 1979. I was figuring out this morning, I really can't believe it, 44 years ago. Wow. And I was 240 pounds. I was miserable. I couldn't fit into anything. Every day I'd wake up and this is the day I'm going to diet. Chubby my whole life. It was a typical middle-class Jewish family. Everything, holidays, food, celebrations, funerals, unveilings, whatever it was. The emotions were always soothed by the food. And, for my mother to serve a pound of steak as the protein in a meal was a normal thing. So I come from excessive eating, and it was never enough. If we'd go to my aunt's house, we'd always say, she's so stingy the way she served. Just a little bit, crazy thinking. My father had a luncheonette in Manhattan, and so he'd bring home all the leftovers kind of at the end of the week. And it was just wonderful eating and love, and so it became synonymous. And I started, my first lie was over food. Who ate the cupcakes? My sister. I could never take responsibility for anything. She was 2 years old when I was six. Craziness. And, my dishonesty grew, and this program just changed. I can't talk enough about the changes in me, the wonderful life that I now live because of the 12-step way of life. And I don't want to get too, but a little bit of, connection. I was humiliated. I remember them calling my weight across the sixth grade gym class. In eighth grade, I weighed 213 pounds. My aunt took me to these places where they would take the weight off you by the use of machines that vibrated and rotated. And it was just humiliation after humiliation. I couldn't fit into a normal size. I joined the band in high school. They had to go to the back of the closet where it was so dusty to get me a size that fit around my waist. So I blamed everything on the fat. I mean, I didn't realize at the time, but when I didn't get into the sorority, well, they don't like me because I'm fat. And so it became a very convenient, not taking responsibility. I always blamed and didn't realize that the three fingers are pointing back at me. So I grew up in this program, and when I first came in and you told me it was a disease, it wasn't my fault, it wasn't about willpower, I could never understand why I couldn't conquer this. I did well in school, and yeah, so that was very comforting to me, that it was a disease. Didn't like the God talk too much because, never really heard God in my life. It was more about, and I relate to you, Jeff, the deli. I was a deli Jew. It was all about the food. And at any rate, you told me it was a disease. I took a sponsor. I started working the steps. I lost 100 pounds in 10 months because I'm a very good follower. And today, I think that's probably why I'm successful in this program. I make a commitment, and I'm very responsible. And I do today what I did yesterday. And I start every day now, and this wasn't from day one, but I have a spiritual morning time. When I came in, God was very uncomfortable for me. Didn't know if I believed, didn't know what God was. And many years later, when I became abstinent, because I have 21 and a half years, so it was in 2002 that I was finally ready to give up the bullshit of halfway, using this, using that. I always kept off 50 pounds of the 100. It was a miracle. I never went back up to where I came in. So that's been a lot of years, but I wasn't at a healthy body weight until 2002 when I was willing to say, you know, I've got to seek God. It says in the big book, it's a spiritual program. And I worked the steps, and I didn't quite get that spiritual peace. And it's really more in the seeking, I've been told, in the rooms. And no matter if you call it God or the universe, we all have our own conception of God. That's another beautiful thing about the program. I don't have to take my son's conception when he became Orthodox and he's a rabbi and he's very religious and observant. I tried that. I always tried what someone else had. You know, people would smoke pot and the Beatles became, you know, all the rage. So I went after the pot. I went after the transcendental meditation, but always looking for the solution outside. And it took many years to realize it's like the Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz. You can go home anytime you want to. And that small, still voice within that many call God, and I think that my intuition and, you know, God is everywhere for me today. But it took many years. And in 2000, you know, so my first foray into program for 20 years, I did speaking and I did workshops and I went to retreats, and but then I would pick up again. And I had various food plans. I had different sponsors. It was the sponsor's fault. It was the food plan's fault. But finally in 2002, I said, let me just seek God. And I had a sponsor who made me write, What do you think of when you say God? And I wrote words, beautiful and, you know, truth and all these wonderful words. And I see God in babies and in people. And so it wasn't just nature, but in the reality of life and my parents. And so that was my beginning of coming to believe that a power greater than myself. And I was that food obsession just kind of released. You know, not to say that I never want to pick up and that every meal is perfect. Sometimes I overeat. Sometimes I make choices that I don't like. But I'm able at most times to think about the barroom the next morning when there's vomit all over the place and the chairs are in disarray. Like, what's it doing to me? What's it doing for me? It's going to take the edge off, but what's it doing to me? And that has become just kind of second nature. So, you know, I don't even look. I just started in a Mahjong game. I've been trying for 10 years to get, you know, people play Mahjong, but in Los Angeles, you need to play in the same area. Otherwise, it takes you an hour and a half to get there. So I finally started, and lo and behold, they're not OA people. I had a wonderful Mahjong game on Long Island. We all brought our lunch. It was no serving. Here, they serve in the middle of the game. But you know what? I don't have to pick up that stuff. And now it's in my house this following Tuesday. So I'm going crazy. Should I buy this? Should I buy that? The overeater lives there. I am not cured, but I do have that reprieve. And I, like I started to say, I have a morning routine. When I get up in the morning, I have my time with God. I have a special chair. I have a beautiful view out the window. And I do meditation, whether it's 5 minutes or 30 minutes, whether it's guided or just breathing in and out. It doesn't matter. Just set the timer for a minute. Have that willingness to try something new. And it's become pretty much without fail, whether I'm on vacation, whether I'm running late. If I'm running late, I'll do maybe a 12-minute. But basically, I'm doing a 30-minute meditation in the morning. I never thought I could do that. I had gone to some retreat in Omega Institute in upstate New York, and it still resonates with me. She said, be like a queen riding on your horse, and you're going through your kingdom. And what, you know, check out your mind, the landscape of your mind, the landscape of your heart, the landscape of your body, and the landscape of your soul. So I kind of set the timers, like pings at different times, and that's my preferred meditation. During the pandemic, I picked up a sangha, and I went every week, and I was, you know, that's one of the reasons that I never tuned into Kitchen Sink. It became important, and it was 9 o'clock every day of the week. And I slowly let go of that. You know, because we started with something doesn't mean that I have to keep it up for a lifetime. You know, it worked then. It's like friends, they come into your life, you know, for a reason, a season, or a lifetime. And we don't know why. And I've learned to wear my garment, you know, wear life more as a loose garment. So for today, I eat anything. It's a miracle. I didn't come in saying, well, I can't give up ice cream. I can't. I follow different food plans. And then 1 year, about 15 years ago, you know, because when I became abstinent, I was, you know, eating. I wasn't eating sugar. And I don't know. We were at a family gathering. They said, oh, just taste it. And I, you know, it's not for everyone. But we're all allergic to different things. I'm allergic to feeling too full. I watch myself. I don't want to get too full. At a holiday meal, I have to be careful because I still like to eat quantity. And lo and behold, it didn't make me want to go home and eat the whole box or bag. So I don't choose to eat it, but I can eat anything, and that's a miracle. I didn't come here for that. But it's just my truth. I have to tell you the truth. In fact, this morning I was doing a reading, and it quoted Dr. Seuss, and I just loved it. It says, be who you are and say what you feel, because those who mind don't matter, and those who matter don't mind. That's a Dr. Seuss quote. So I'm telling you my truth. Doesn't mean that that's the way for you. I've learned so many wonderful truths in this program. And another quote that comes to my mind is, you know, I was basically a negative, pessimistic type person. And I had a really struggle to get to sea level. In fact, when I shared, I used to say that I needed my morning time to just kind of get up to that sea level. And by the way, today is the 23rd of September. And I read that it's the equinox. So we have the equal amount of light and darkness. And I always try to be in balance. And that's something I learned in this program, because I used to be really moody. I'd be really high and really low. And now I strive to be in balance. The middle path, the gray area. These are all wonderful truths that I learned in program. During the pandemic, I really picked up meditation. And I also picked up, Bill Wilson had said that after you get the booze down, we work on our emotional sobriety. And I've been working on that. And really, that has helped me get to a new level in my recovery. You know, it's taught me to let go of those expectations. We hear that they're terrible. And, you know, the more I expect, the more disappointed I'm going to be. And, you know, being a perfectionist, I have to let go of those perfectionistic ideas. I am not perfect. This morning, I called somebody by their wrong name. I feel embarrassed, but you know what? It's okay. I can say I'm sorry and hold my head up. I'm human. I've learned that I'm human. In emotional sobriety, I've learned that life is not fair. You know, some of us have horrendous things happen. Some of us, you know, not so much. I'm very healthy at my age. In fact, this last summer, I went to South Africa with my Orthodox son, and we were 16 of us. We went on a safari. I went snorkeling with the seals. I mean, you know, I could never have done that at 240 pounds. I never would have even thought about doing it. I walk. I am healthy. There will be illness. There will be old age. So when I pray, So it was somebody who said, you don't pray to be healthy, pray to be strong. because there will be ill health, there will be challenges, and you know, we all go through deaths and grief and sad times, and the program helps to get through it. What other goodies can I tell you? Okay, step seven, I guess six and seven is where we are for a lifetime. Yeah, we have to make amends, and when I'm wrong, I promptly admit it. Oh, I'll tell you something I did this summer that I'm not at all feeling good about, but I made my amends. So I'm blessed with four great grandchildren. So the oldest is five, and we went shell picking. We were in Cape Town, and we got beautiful shells, and she had a really magnificent shell. And we're back at the place we're staying, and I'm thinking, I really want that shell. But she's not going to give it to me. So I'll just take the shell home. She'll never miss it. I mean, here I am at age 83 still stealing from my great-granddaughter. And I rationalize it. I'm very good at rationalizing. So I Zoom with them every week. And one day I said, Sprucker, I have something I have to tell you. And I showed her the shell, and she didn't remember it. I said, you know, this is your shell. Bubby took it home by mistake. I didn't quite own up to that. So please forgive me, and when I come back to Israel, I'll bring it. And those are the things that keep me clean, that keep my side of the street clean. But the emotional sobriety helps me with step six and seven, you know, to be more humble. And people do things not to hurt me. They do things for themselves, you know, whether it's me or somebody else, you know, and I have so many unenforceable rules. Oh, my goodness. This really messes me up at every stage, because my unenforceable rule, my husband is supposed to take out the garbage. You know, it's ridiculous. You know, and I would nag him, or just to give you a silly, you know, example. But the fewer, you know, when I take away the unenforceable rules and the shoulds that I put on myself or the shoulds that I put on you, I'm a much happier person. I'm a much healthier person. I'm a much more humble person. And so that need to be right that I think I picked up, because since I was fat and chubby, so at least I'm going to be right. I'm going to be smart. I'm going to know the answer. And I don't like being a beginner, because I want to, or, you know, you already should have mastered that. I forget what the acronym is, but yeah, thanks. So I'm learning all these good things, and they help me with letting go of, you know, we call them defects. I don't know if they're defects. They're habits that I picked up along the way for survival, to try to, you know, make my life good. So I don't take things personally sometimes, but that's a big one. You know, I've just learned that I want to be, you know, no one is coming. I have to be my own savior. I have to be my own decider, my own decision maker. You know, don't give my power away. And so I'm learning that. I sponsor a great many women, and I love that. That's my anchor. Every day I speak to at least two or three women. We read outside literature. I love our literature, but to help me grow and get more psychologically healthy, I read very many books, spiritual books, and that's very helpful. So during the pandemic, I loved the Zoom meetings. We met people from all over the world. I was going to seven meetings a week. I loved the routine. But now we're out of the pandemic, thank God. And so I've started going back to in-person meetings. I started, you know, I'm an isolator. I think most of us are. And I was very comfortable at home in my little box. So, you know, getting out there and having to say, oh, I put my foot in my mouth again, it's a little scary. If there were no people to interact with, I could have a beautiful life. You know, I mean, you know, it gets complicated. It gets difficult. But, you know, I eat with dignity and grace. That's my abstinence. I try to be a good person. I try to be kind and compassionate. My mother, when I was younger, would say, "You're mean and rotten." And those things, those beliefs stay in our head. I'm no longer mean and rotten. And I'm not the person that came into these rooms all those years ago. I've learned from all of you. You know, I'm thrilled to be a part of this fellowship. I love it. I think I always wanted to live in the penthouse. I remember Bill B. in his compulsive eating book talked about it's not good enough. We come in, we're in the gutter, and then we get abstinent. We're on the sidewalk. But he wants to live in the penthouse. That's great, but that's a little unrealistic. I can't be in the penthouse all the time. The sidewalk is quite good. I have to bring down that perfectionism, the expectations, the, you know, yes, be as great as you can be, but there are other people and they each have their own greatness and we're all equal in God's eyes. And I'm thrilled to be back and see my old friends, and thanks for listening. Okay. This is the time for questions only. There is no sharing at this meeting. If you need to share, please do so with any one of us after the meeting. Also, please remember that the opinions of the leaders are my own and not those of Overeaters Anonymous as a whole. When asking questions, you need not identify yourself. Please remember, if you ask a question, your voice may be audible on the OA podcast. I will restate the question after it is asked. Okay. Julie.
Thank you, Roberta. So having blamed everything that didn't go your way on being fat, what happened when you no longer were? Okay, it didn't go your way.
Thank you. Julie asked, having blamed everything on my being fat, then when I wasn't fat anymore, how did I deal with it when things didn't go my way? Great question. That was a real eye-opener. And I think the first time that I lost 100 pounds in 1980, that was one of the reasons I couldn't keep that perfectionistic dream. And I think that's one of the reasons that I broke my abstinence and couldn't maintain that, because I didn't have a place to blame anymore. Through working the program and getting this beautiful design for living, I'm able to say, yeah, I was an a-hole. I'm much more, since I like myself, because at a healthy body weight, I don't know, I mean, I weigh myself every morning. It's just what I do, because if I eat too much, I think I gained 100 pounds back. So that keeps me emotionally, okay, you like the way you look. You're happy about the way you look. And so then I can take responsibility somehow and say I was wrong. Because I always wanted, you know, when I was 8 years old and we had a Queen Esther contest, and my mother and aunt said, "Oh, you're going to win this contest because you know, they sewed this gorgeous gown for me." And I didn't win it. And they whispered to each other, "It's because she's chubby, because she's fat." So after getting over that and saying, you know what, I'm okay. And if I fall on my face, it's okay, because I still like myself. I think that self-hatred has dissipated, since I always wanted to be at a thin body. I feel like I am at a thin body. So that gives me the self-esteem that I can now say, okay, I made a mistake. Thanks. Yeah, James.
Hey, Roberta, how are you? Thank you for your lead. You spoke about starting a real search in 2002, and I wondered what that seeking looked like in 2002 and how it developed over those 21 years.
Okay, thanks. How did my spiritual seeking develop over the last 21 years? So I started by just writing on a piece of paper, as I said, all the different adjectives and attributes of God that I thought God had. And then after that, people in this program taught me how to talk to God. I never knew how to talk to God. And we would go and we went to a facility where they had people who were had bariatrics or thinking about having bariatric surgery. And she said, let's say a prayer together before we go in, asking God to guide us. So just starting to talk, to have a conversation with God other than Baruch Atah Adonai, you know, from the prayer book, opened me a little bit that, gee, I could ask God, please help me to be more humble today, to not, you know, whatever it was that I needed. And I started going, a lot of my friends in program were of another religion, and they would go for spiritual counseling, I guess you'd call it. They'd go to the nuns or they'd go to different places. And there was a woman in program who was learning to be a Jewish spiritual counselor. She was a social worker. And so she said, well, come once a month. And in going to her, she'd bring God in if I'd be talking about an issue that I had with my husband. You know, well, bring God into it. And so I learned to just pause more and to not always have to be running the engine on my own, independent, knowing all the answers. You know, if I need a good mechanic, I can ask you, where do you go to get your car done? You know, not needing to just be in self-drive all the time. And that opened me up. I went to different, you know, I tried to go the Jewish route. That doesn't really speak to me. It speaks to me the way I do it, and it's good enough. I learned self-love somehow and to be okay with my decisions. And I learned that in the rooms here when we talk about everyone, you know, whether you're atheist, whether you're agnostic, whether you're very observant religious, you know, and you have a lot of rituals or you have none. We all have our own way. And so now there are certain rituals that I do that are Jewish. I light Shabbos candles. I do certain things that appeal to me. I don't fast on Yom Kippur. I don't go to synagogue. That never spoke to me. So I think trusting your heart and your intuition is what got me to where I am right now. Thank you. Ainsley.
Thank you so much for your labor, Roberta. Lovely to see you. When you do, like, maybe eat something and you don't feel good about it already, how do you let go of it and not spin out over it?
How do I let go of an inappropriate choice of my food or something like that? It's kind of one of the things that I learned in this program, not to hold on to anything. You know, if anything, I've learned acceptance and letting go. Acceptance. And if I'm having trouble accepting it, you know, just keep trying to accept it. If I can't accept it, I just better let go of it. So it kind of works for me that way. I put down that whip in 2002 when I became abstinent. And I don't pick it up for the food at all. And I'm much better now at not picking it up for mistakes that I make. I just try to correct. I say I'm sorry. I try to make living amends. I don't repeat it the next day. Just keep moving forward. Don't get stuck in the ditch, you know. It's like that, whether you're stuck on snow or in mud, you're going to spin those wheels unless you just kind of give it a lean in another direction. And I lean into let it go if it's too much for you. Let it go. Thanks. Jeff.
Thank you, Verna. From one daily view to another, when you encounter someone who you might have fought years ago, what do you do in the moment, since we've ceased fighting anything or anyone, what do you do in the moment to not have that unpleasant interaction or friction with somebody?
Yeah. How do you, in the moment, not engage with somebody who's pushing your buttons? Well, maybe I'm at a 25 or 30% there. That's a tough one. And I get into that. I don't like to be criticized, and I get into that defensive mode. The more I read about my need to be right, I know that it's contained in there. And so the more I can kind of be vulnerable and not make a fool of myself, but say, you know what, this was not a wise choice, or, yeah. And I've learned in program that sacred word, pause. If I could just pause more, I'll have a much better response. But that reaction is still strong. So we learn little phrases like respond, don't react. So, you know, try to sit with it. That's probably the most challenging thing. And, you know, so like I say, maybe I'm successful part of the time. And I look at that as a little win. Tough one. Thanks. Carol.
So when your counselor says bring God into it, what does that look like for you?
It looks like somebody who's my cheerleader loves me so much, my best self. It's like my authentic self, the person that I would like to be. God is very much now being internalized in me, and I feel that with my kind deeds, you know, that's how I bring God into it. You know, what they said, we used to have those bracelets, you know, what would Jesus do? What would God do? And I do a two-way prayer letter every morning to God. And so I ask God a question, and it could be a mundane thing or a detailed thing. And God is always saying, Roberta dear, darling, sweetheart, bubala, I love you so much. And it's really like that love, the greatest love in the world. And that's what I bring into it. And that love wants me to succeed and wants me to be happy and wants the best for me. And that's how God looks for me.
All right. I'm assuming you still have the disease talking to you. How do you handle it when you really have these craving thoughts and you really have an obsession about food?
How do I handle crazy thoughts and obsession with food? It's hard to handle it at the moment. That's where the tools come in. Like I made 3 outreach calls yesterday. I felt so great. I spoke to somebody I hadn't spoken to in about 6 months. And it's always giving service and getting out of yourself. I mean, that's always the answer. When I came into Los Angeles 10 years ago, after a lifetime of OA on the East Coast, I dove right in. I got into the center of the herd. And it's really hard in the moment when you're in the store and you want it. Making a phone call is a great thing. Having a buddy, a non-binge buddy, or however you want to call it, that you could call or text. I want to buy it. Just sometimes outing myself takes away that need to buy it. Just saying out loud to somebody else, I really want to buy that now. It's so strong. And, you know, go take a walk. There are a lot of, there's a list of stuff you can do. And it's really hard at the moment. That's why going to meetings, using the tools, reading, writing throughout the day will make it that much easier. But there's no easy answer to when that strikes. Yeah. Just see if you can just turn around and look at it from a different perspective. I don't know. Yeah. Yes, Mark. Hi.
Thank you. In the pandemic, we've become comfortable in our routines, just going on Zoom and having our own little world. How have you been breaking out of that, going, you know what, I need to change this, you know, and being able to say, because we love routine and we love our safe little area.
Yeah, how do we change routine now that we're kind of out of the pandemic? So I can only talk for me. The Zoom meetings just kind of became a little difficult. And I still go to maybe one or two. But now that the quality of the sharing, when you're looking at people's faces and you're actually hugging each other, It is so appealing to me that I made a, you know, I'm going to go to a live meeting at least Saturday and Sunday. And I think it's important to, you know, try different meetings, because as wonderful as this meeting is and always was for me, I'd often walk out not really having connected with people. So I need a meeting where I'm going to get a chance to share. So find a small meeting where everybody gets their 3 minutes, because a lot of times it's in the sharing that we feel heard, and that, you know, helps me a lot. So I've looked for meetings where there is sharing and there is that kind of, you know, not somebody speaking from the podium. I mean, they're great and I love those meetings, and they're strong, and we record it so people all over the world can hear it. But for me, I need those intimate meetings too. And I used to love the meetings at St. Thomas Church in Hollywood, but we haven't gotten them going again. So I look for other meetings that serve that purpose. Maybe we got to get a committee to get those meetings going again. Yeah, so I slowly come off Zoom. And Zoom has been wonderful, because now I have a book club for my friends on Long Island that I had to let go of when I moved here, and we meet every Wednesday for 2 hours. I meet with my sponsees once a week. We have a nice thing going, and I started emotional sobriety a once a week meeting. So I didn't discount Zoom altogether, but for me, there's nothing like a live meeting. And we are lucky. They are popping up more and more. Any other questions? Michael.
Thanks, Roberta. So I was curious about your mom. Was she alive when you got abstinence? And if so, how did you work an eighth and a ninth step around her?
Okay.
You know, my mom, because of the damn kid, is what you might think.
Right.
But, so, did you make amends? Were you able to do that? Or how did you work the program?
Yeah, how did I work the program about my mom? And my mom died before I got this really good abstinence. She died 1997. So I was in my first phase of OA, where I was up and down the 50 pounds, but I was working the steps. And my mom was, I believe, a compulsive eater. She was quite obese. And, you know, I had a lot of identification with her growing up. So, you know, maybe if I were a normal size, I wouldn't have had as much hatred toward her. But she had a lot of my, I'd come home from school and I'd give it to her. You know, I'd hold it in all day and scream and yell at her. So she came to a few OA meetings. She even came to Grossinger's with me when we had a convention up there. She never identified, and that's fine. But I was able to make my amends. You know, I think she was able to understand. She heard in the rooms, and I'm very grateful that she lived long enough to be in the rooms with me and listen. And I was able to make amends in person. And then in 2002, after my real conversion, or whatever you want, transformation, I don't know. I think we're transformed from the minute we walk into OA. We just all have a, it's not always a path in one direction. It's up and down and in and out, but you know, it kills eating for you. Once you come to Overeaters Anonymous, you can never eat without feeling guilty again. You know better. So I think that I made a, I don't recall, but I remember going to the cemetery. I don't recall if I wrote a letter or if I just verbalized all the things that I was sorry for, that I didn't appreciate. And to this day, I appreciate her. Mom, I'm, you know, she was such a good mother. She worried a lot, and I always used to focus on her negative thoughts. But now I can appreciate, and I talk to her now. I do believe that people who pass away are connected to us, and we can still talk to them. So I'm still making amends. We're still connecting with her. Yeah, thanks. Yes, K.
chaos.
Can you talk a little bit about the flip side of that, about mothering children as a person in program?
Okay, mothering children as a person in program. So there's a big difference between smothering and mothering, because I'm a smotherer, and I have a 7-year-old grandson who lives right close by, and I get to see him often during the week. And, you know, it's that old story. You can give people fish or you can teach them how to fish. So I think by my modeling how I handle situations, how I handle problems, or if he tells me something, throwing it back to him, what can you do differently? And he's a wonderful grandson, and he's a very unusual kid. He's really into people, and he's got a kind heart. But he's a 7-year-old boy, and he's got a lot of energy, and he drives my daughter crazy, and they're always asking for advice. So they came up with this point system last week, and it seems to be working. You know, he likes to count. He likes reward and punishment, and he likes to be good. So he's getting points, and if he gets 10 points, he can sleep over Bubby's house, and that kind of thing. So I use my program knowledge to help me to model good behavior. You know, it's not what we say, it's what we do. Yeah. Okay, I think time's up, so thank you all. Time for second.